My name is Dustin Kelly, but everybody calls me DJ. I'm prior Army, serving as both a Ford Observer and a military police officer. I've spent the last 14 and a half years as a police officer and detective in a large metropolitan police department. Two things that I've learned throughout my career. One, everybody has a story to tell. And two, the best stories are true. This is the DTD Podcast. In 3, 2, 1, and we're live. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the DTD Podcast. This week in the studio, my guest started out life with a sometimes troubled childhood, but quickly got a glimpse at the future of service when his grandparents enrolled him in a military academy. While attending that academy, my guest realized that work without purpose was meaningless. Joining the Marines in 2005, he once again got off to a bumpy start until he again discovered that he was not performing at his full potential and got to work becoming the best possible version of himself by being selected into the famed MARSOC Raiders. He has combat deployments to both Iraq and Afghanistan, where he suffered not only physically, but also found that the scars of war follow you well past your time in service. My guest is an entrepreneur, a CEO, a master trainer, and an author. He not only received his master's degree, but was also awarded top 100 MBAs in the country. On top of all that, he's the founder and CEO of the Underwater Torpedo League, Deep End Fitness, and co-founder of the Marine Raider Challenge. It's with great respect and honor that I introduce you to Prime Hall. What's going on, my friend?
What's up, brother? Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you so much for that amazing introduction.
Yeah, absolutely, man. You deserve it. With everything I've heard, everything that I've read about you, everything that I've studied, your story to me stands out because when you look at it from the beginning, there was every chance you had to mess this thing up completely. And somehow you came around each adversity stronger and stronger every single time. So let's start out with that childhood. You're a Texas boy, Corpus Christi. I want you to give me kind of an overview of your parents, their parenting style, how your relationship was with them, and then we're going to move right into your grandparents.
My relationship with my parents, both with my biological parents, today is great. We have a working relationship and we get along great. I talk to both of them on a routine basis, and I'm in communication with everybody on both sides of my family. To answer your question, I feel like they were trying to figure it out. My dad worked in the oil industry and in refineries. And so, and then my mom was a stay-at-home mom. When I was at a young age, started to become rocky. And then they didn't know how to handle that. And then they didn't know how to keep their marriage going. And on top of that, I think there was financial stress and these other things. But my mom's parenting style was very supportive, takes me to school, does that kind of stuff, makes sure that I have like a nice birthday party and all that, but like never disciplined, not disciplinary at all. And then my dad was have a bad day or, you know, whatever was going on at the time, on top of whatever I was doing or whatever happened, whatever was going on with me that was creating more stress. And then I would get dealt with, or not spankings, but actually, you know, beatings. That's kind of how the parenting style worked. And then kind of got separated throughout whenever I was a teenager. And then I ended up going to military school, as you mentioned, and my grandparents stepped in. So was the second part of your question about my grandparents?
Well, no, I want to kind of focus on your parents for a minute right now, because it's such a different story from each of the parents. You have a mom that wants to make sure, she's almost like your friend growing up. She wants to make sure that you're happy, you get presents, all those kind of things. but there's no really giving you, you know, a way to move your life or a way to make your life better other than through the presence and letting you know you're free. Then you have your dad on the other hand that, you know, is physically abusive at times to you, is a very authoritarian in your lifetime and at that point in your life. It's almost super mixed signals. And so how do you as a kid deal with that? Because you really kind of folded into yourself and took care of yourself. So how did you look at the parenting as a kid of two, I think you would agree, extreme ends of the spectrum?
Looking through it now, it's kind of like I can look at it now and it's different than whenever I was going through it. Because whenever I was going through it, that's all I knew. So I don't know that that's not normal. That's normal to me. That's what I know. And so I think that I found ways to cope and deal with it whenever I was growing up. And the ways that I would do it was I would introvert and go in and just internalize everything and start to compartmentalize it and start to find these weird things that I could tell myself that I could take control of the situation. Whenever I get hit, I can't control when I'm going to get hit. But when I get hit, I can control the fact that after one or two hits, I'm not going to feel anything. Because now I know that that's probably my adrenaline's kicking in or whatever that is. But I knew back then, even as a very young kid, that I can control that. And then I can control that so that you can't take my power away or weaken me by your weak actions of coming in and trying to hit me, you know, so I could take control of the situation and know that after that first or second hit. And this was how I handled being jumped in the park. And whenever I was a freshman in high school, I used to get beat up in the parking lot by the seniors sometimes. And it was like, you know, I would rather be able to walk away and be able to, you know, fire back in those situations and then take a couple of hits. Cause I knew that since I was a very young kid that you could hit me a few times and it's really nothing. It means nothing.
Do you think that helped you out further in your career? And I don't want to jump too far ahead in your career, but knowing that and knowing all I got to do is get through this, do you think that helped you get through all of the training that you did, through all of the deployments that you did, knowing that you could without a doubt go into your brain and compartmentalize everything that was going on almost immediately?
Yes. Looking back on it, I feel that, and I know now, even though it's given me carrying those memories and that stuff from childhood, especially on top of the military stuff, it really became mentally challenging to deal with those two cycles of memories. Now I've had a breakthrough from that. I've been able to reframe it and see it more that, okay, wow, those things that happened to me that started happening whenever I was maybe 7 years old. And that was this high level training that I started to get when I was a young kid that set me up because, and I say this with full humility. So I just want to explain that first off with the deployments and everything, there's always an imposter syndrome or a comparison trap that I've talked about before, but that I really want to emphasize that and that we all compare ourselves and think, oh, well, like me, I only had 4 or 5 deployments. So, you know, there's people that have 30 deployments, 20 and crazy stuff. So I just, and I got out in 12 and a half years of being in the Marines. So there's people that do 25 years and I know you're at 17 years in your profession, but you know, I'm just trying to say that, put it into perspective on that. But then looking back at it now, I know that when we were in really bad situations overseas, and sometimes, you know, not everybody around you is an operator, not everyone around you is even a Marine or has been through military training. Some of them might be a contractor that's a generator mechanic, or you might have something and they've never been through training to be where they're at. And now they're in, you know, in an enemy village in the middle of Afghanistan. Maybe there's things that happened to them in life that prepared them for that. But what we saw a lot, or what you would see a lot in those situations in any country, whenever really bad things would happen is that people would fold up in bad situations. And I mean, honestly, I felt like it happened to me in certain situations when I got all of a sudden shot at from all directions and I had nowhere to move. It's like, I felt like I folded up in those couple seconds, and luckily someone was able to call ceasefire or whatever happened. But anybody at a certain stress level can fold up. And so I feel like I was blessed with those experiences as a young kid, that it built me to be able to handle those other events that happen. It's crazy how it all shakes out.
I want to talk about, because you talk a lot about PTS, TBIs, different things like that. I want people to understand, if they haven't heard your story before, that TBIs and stuff with you started very early in life. I think at the age of 7, you fell and cracked a lot of your skull and had like a year of rehab and all that kind of stuff. Can we talk about that a little bit? Because I think, once again, it ties into later on in your life of when those injuries happen. You know, you couldn't play in gym and you couldn't swim certain things. You couldn't go underwater. So you felt like you didn't have a purpose. Did it help you later on in life? So can we kind of talk about the story and then how it helped you later on in your life?
Wow. So, and this is another crazy, it's just crazy how these things connect. But when I was 7, I was at, not the house that I had the Peeping Tom, but the house that we lived in before that. I was outside. We had this wrought iron gate that went to a little brick wall that was about 7 feet tall that was in front of our house. And so I was standing up, I would climb up the wrought iron gate, and then I would move onto that brick wall and I would walk the brick wall and hang out on it. I went up the wrought iron gate. So I was standing all the way at the top. So I was actually, instead of being at 7 feet, I was probably up at maybe, you know, 10 or 11 feet or wherever I was at. My mom was in the front yard and she yelled out, "Hey, you're going to fall." I fell right back. Or, "Oh my gosh, you're going to fall." And sure enough, I fell straight back directly on my head. So I blacked out and they were like trying to keep me awake, going to the hospital. I got to the hospital. That was the first time I was ever in an MRI machine. So my head was complete mush. My skull was completely fractured. Thank God that all of the bleeding was external and none of it was internal bleeding. From there, it took a year for my skull to build back and take form, but my whole skull and like my skull cap was all complete mush. So like super soft, it wasn't hard. There were certain things that I couldn't do. And in PE or any time that my class got to go outside, I would be put in a different group and then be not going outside and not allowed to do any stuff. So I think that stuff really does play a part in your life and comes into play. And I don't, and you know, so I'm just sitting there kind of internalizing everything, sat there with a mushy skull for a year from like 7 to 8 and couldn't do any of the things. I grew up since I was like 2 living at the pool, because one of my grandmothers was a synchronized swimmer when she was younger, a place that had a community pool. And so that became a real thing for me, where every summer when I was out of school, I would always have like some type of a pool membership in the local community stuff where I could go, and that would be my thing. So not having to, I wasn't able to swim or do anything like that for a year. Yeah, I think that plays into it, because now I love being underwater and I try to push that as much as I can.
Now, you said that in high school you got beat up as a freshman and stuff like that. Did you have friends growing up? Were you a popular kid? Were you kind of to your own? Because I feel like in everything that I've read, it almost seems like you would have been kind of off on your own a lot.
It was a combination, because what happened after so I went through elementary school and middle school, and I feel like I kind of started getting popular around 4th grade. That's where I started, like the friends that I had in like 4th and 5th grade. Back then we used to watch these strongman competitions, and then it turned into UFC and all this stuff, but we were doing all this, like, we would fight each other in the grass in front of their yard and stuff. In middle school, I got more friends. Those were my best friends that were those, like, those warrior kids, and they were all brothers. But then I got more friends in middle school. And so, but we all lived in that area. And then the high school that that middle school fed into, my parents divorced when I was in eighth grade. So before high school, I got moved to a new area and lived in a condo. My mom had moved away with my sister, and my dad had lived in the condo with me, but my dad had mostly stayed in and lived with his girlfriend at that time. So my dad was barely there, and I was staying at this place, and I went to a new district. So I went to a high school that I didn't know barely anybody, but like three people when I started, as opposed to being at a place with all my friends that I grew up with. And so at that point, I wasn't felt isolated more. And then the way that the fights thing happened was, it's just like that movie Dazed and Confused. I think they watch these things, and then that becomes the culture that they're trying to emulate. And so they're doing these freshman initiation bullshit things. And so that's what all the kids that were popular go to this thing. And so since I'm a popular kid coming from where I'm from, I get invited to the freshman initiation, and I get there, and they're like paddling people and doing all this shit. I'm like, I'm not going to let you fucking paddle me. What? Like, nah, this is bullshit. You know? So I kind of rebelled against that initiation. And then, so the rest of the year, they tried to catch me in the parking lot and stuff like that. And it was a super challenging time for sure.
Well, let's be honest. You were pretty much living on your own. I mean, you briefly touched on it that your dad was with his girlfriend a lot, but you pretty much lived on your own. You had a hardship license. You figured out how to get your own food. I mean, let's be honest about that, because I think that's a big thing, because one more time at age 7, at age 15, you're kind of folding in on yourself, relying on yourself again to take care of what needs to be taken care of.
Yeah. One thing that really did was it made me super resourceful in life and street smart. But yeah, so that, but during that first condo, like right when I got into high school, my dad was there a little bit, but then we moved into an apartment. And then at that place, that's where I was mostly there by myself. I lived there from the end of my freshman year through my sophomore year. And then after that, I went to military school. But when I was living in there by myself, like I had a hardship license. When I needed to get fuel, I knew where I could steal gas from, and I could basically pump my car and then be able to get away. And so I had these specific things that I would kind of rotate through. And then the ways that I would get food is I would go through and either eat a meal at a restaurant and then have there be a hare in it. Right. And then I get it for free. And then I get to eat, you know, a meal. This is like on a special occasion. Or I go through a fast food restaurant. And this was the other thing that I used to do. And I would just say, hey, I came through here earlier. I had this, this, and this, and this was missing from my bag, you know. And this is like what I was doing when I was 15, 16 to eat dinner. And anyway, it was interesting. I mean, I don't know how that shit works out.
What's so interesting to me about it is you still talk to your dad. I mean, it would have been very simple to reach out to him to ask him for money, or to your grandparents, because it was your grandparents that ultimately came in and took you away from that place. But it would have been very easy. The part that is so crazy about your whole story to me is you see you do these great things and you excel at everything that you're doing, and then you almost do self-fulfilling prophecies where you just crash and burn yourself so bad your whole life, and see it just time and time again. Like, you're 15 years old, you can easily ask for help, but instead you'd rather be resourceful, steal food, steal the gas, things like that. Why do you think that is? Because that's the most, and I say that in no you know, funny terms. That is the most fascinating part of your story to me.
It's kind of mind blowing to hear you say that, but I see the patterns as you're saying that. And the best answer, the thing that comes to mind is that, and have you ever heard like an instructor in training say, all right, guys, you know, you're either going to be smart or you're going to be hard, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. I'm always in life, I feel like I'm smart now but I'm always in life done things the hard way. And then I have to ram through the wall and then figure it out. So I have a hard time asking for help. And I always have since I was a little kid, because I always tried to control everything and master everything. Like, I would be as independent as possible. Even whenever I was a young kid, I used to mow lawns and do everything, have my own job so that I could depend on myself. And I didn't like to ask for help, even very, very young. So I'm not carrying that like as a badge of honor. I really have, and am still trying to work on, you know, being open, talking about whenever about when things are bothering me.
So let's give an example of that. We've talked about your grandparents briefly, and you had a completely different relationship with them as a young person, you know, growing up into the military and stuff like that. Your grandparents come and they see you in this apartment that you're living on your own. They take you away from it. They put you in this military school, and you go there. And you do fantastic. You excel there. You learn from these Marine Corps instructors. And by all means, you're doing amazing. Then you get out. You come home for spring break. You do whatever at like 18. You start working in South Padre Island. And you get in trouble again. What I'm trying to put together in your story is you have these flashes of greatness at the military academy. And then you come here and it almost seems like you forget all about it. And is that where that drive without purpose thing kind of comes into effect?
Yeah, it does. I never had anyone in my immediate family that was Marines or that was military. So when I went to military school, there was never an intent that this was going to set you up to go to the military. It just happened to plant the seeds with me, because as I was in military school, we would have these leadership classes, or we would have all these different things, and I would see videos and videos of obstacle courses and force recon Marines and kind of combat training and all this different stuff, where it kind of planted the seed, like, that's what I want to do. I'm interested in doing that. And so I think it's similar to how people say they saw Rambo movies or something when they were younger and they're like, that's what I want to do. I think that these videos that I had seen at military school, along with the fact that I respected. And the reason why I love military school is because I had all these rules. I had security. I didn't have to worry about any weird people in my window. And I had all these crazy kids that were with me that were so entertaining that I had made a lot of friends with a lot of them as well. So it was a very fun experience.
Let me see if I understand this then. So when you're going there and you're excelling, do you have the idea that you want to go in the military? You say that you saw those videos and you liked it, but then when you get out and you're working in South Padre Island, you're 18 years old. I mean, if we're going to be completely frank about it, you're dealing drugs, you're hanging out with people that you probably shouldn't. And here's where that dichotomy of your life comes into play again, because you have two jobs. You're working, you're supplying for yourself, but then you're doing all this stuff on the side. You're getting put in jail. You're getting in trouble. How did you navigate through that? And how did you end up saying, if I stay on this path, it's going to end bad, and really take that to heart that final time before you went into the Marines?
For anyone that has never checked out South Padre and what it's like at spring break, it's one of the top couples places that people go to for spring break every year. And so if you can imagine, like whenever I was working there, I worked at the Radisson Hotel at the time. They changed the name now, but that was the biggest draw for people to go to that hotel, because it had three pools, and that was where all of the like musicians or sponsored events would be, right there behind the hotel on that part of the beach. And so they would have, you know, the huge Coca-Cola thing or whatever the blow up thing would be right back there. And then they would have, I would be on my lunch break, it'd be Snoop Dogg and Girls Gone Wild, Spring Break, and everywhere that I would go, there would be naked girls and people doing the craziest things and people getting into fights everywhere and people getting stabbed and people getting shot and all types of people getting thrown off the balconies, people getting thrown off the third floors, like craziest shit that I saw when I was living there and working at spring break. Not something that I could see as being a sustainable thing, but just something that I ended up there. And that was kind of survival mode. But how I got that was, I went down to South Padre one day. That's my family lived on the other side of the bridge from South Padre. So I went over to the island one day. The first place that I went, I said, "Hey, what place here, what hotel doesn't drug test?" And they said, "Oh, it's the Radisson," which just happened to be the best hotel to work at. So I went there and got hired that same day. And my job was to serve alcohol to females that were out at the pool. And then there were two females that would serve to males. The amount of alcohol that we would sell during spring break, and it's very seasonal down there. So it would get really crazy and then it would die down, and then it would get crazy and it would die down. But the shit that you would see on a daily basis during those 3 or 4 weeks during spring break would be, you know, you by the end of it, you'd be ready for people to be gone and things to go back to normal.
Now, I've heard you say something. I want you to think about this. This isn't your exact quote, but in a sense, you said you gravitated towards the hitters or the ones where all the action was. That's the people that you hung around with. And that's kind of how you got into drugs, into things like that. But then you go to college and you have a roommate. And by the way, let's point out that you were going to Texas Lutheran College, which is by all means a college that you probably shouldn't be getting in trouble for. And your first roommate is a cocaine dealer.
Yeah, he was. He ended up being that, but he wasn't at the time. So that story is true, but there's a twist to it. So my first roommate at Texas Lutheran was the dean's son. And so this guy, he was like 300 pounds, and we had a police shack, and I just went back there. So they changed this around, but we had a police shack that was like probably 30 meters from outside of our window. We lived in the second floor of the last co-ed dorms that they had there. And so we were on the second floor, and this guy is smoking weed outside of the window. So he couldn't get off of the roof in time for them not to bust him. And then so they came up, busted him. He's a dean's son, so he got kicked out. At that time, they wanted to move me in with this individual that was like a flamboyant transsexual type situation. There was a lot to it because this person was like always outside in front of our dorms doing different things and whatever else. And so when my roommate got kicked out, they tried to switch me with this roommate that I was not going to live with. And then that was enough for me to just bounce. And at the same time that I was leaving, it was about probably the last week of my first semester, I'm out. Leaving Texas Lutheran, and I moved to San Antonio, and I flipped to San Antonio Community College, and I lived in the hood down off of North St. Mary's and lived in a drug house. And that was with the guy that was across the hall from me when I was at Texas Lutheran. Me and him ended up living together, and then we had other roommates that came in. But another thing is I'm grateful for all of that too, because I got all of that drug life and all that stuff out of the way before I went into the military, so that when I got out of the military, there was nothing about any part of me that wanted to go back to any of that, you know, so.
You know, they say that everything happens for a reason, and that's the whole thing. But we need to go back to your grandparents again, because once again, your grandfather steps in and tells you, like, what do you think about going in the military? Is that kind of the way it went down? What did he see that he knew this is not going to end well?
So I had a life-changing experience happen by way of car accident back then. So I went into the Marine Corps in 2005. And I probably applied or started applying at the beginning of 2004, but it took me so long to get in because I had a rap sheet. So I had to get it waivered. Everything had to be waivered and approved and everything so I could get in. But it was the only way I got in was it was the peak of the Iraq war. So They needed numbers, and the recruiting office needed to meet their quota. So they got my paperwork through. But before that, in 2003, I was in a really bad car accident where my dog that I had had for probably 7 years or something gotten lost that day. And I had been looking for it, trying to find it, and then I couldn't find it. I started getting really stressed out, anxiety, whatever. And at the time, I had Xanax bars. The tabs, it's like, and it comes in like a four-sectioned bar. They call them Xanny bars, prescription pill. And so the effects of it, if you've never taken one and you take a full bar, it's going to knock you out. And then if you get used to taking them, then they just like calm your anxiety and make you dumb you down and whatever that feeling is. After military school, I didn't sleep much because we stayed up a lot at military school for days sometimes. My doctor put me on Xanax. After hours of looking for my dog, I couldn't find it. I took some Xanax and I ended up running my Bronco into a telephone pole going full speed and flipping it all the way down a street. No seatbelt on. And ended up, when the car finally stopped, it was upside down and I was lodged. I had no seatbelt on when I crashed, but I was lodged into the vehicle from the impact because I hit a palm tree first. And when I hit that palm tree, my front end locked it. It's like a big Eddie Bauer Broncos, like like an OJ Simpson Bronco. I hit a palm tree going about 80 miles an hour in that thing. And when I hit it, the front end locked in and I started to flip, did like a kick flip off of this palm tree and started, and instead of going through this house, it diverted down the street, thank God. And so it rolled all the way down the street and I ended up upside down and lodged in completely to where I couldn't get out. I couldn't move. And while the thing was flipping, my head had hit the windshield here. So hit the palm tree, the windshield broke and my head smashed it here. And then as it started to flip, started to crush and all the glass started to come in on the dash and on where my face was like this. So my whole face right here got torn apart and I ended up getting reconstructive surgery on my lip to put my lip back. And then I have a bunch of scars all right here. When that thing stopped rolling and I was lodged in, and all this, my face was all cut up and my lip was all ripped off. The blood that was rushing out of my face was a lot. And so I was upside down and just had all this blood. And finally I just passed out. But before I passed out, they started to cut me out. They had to cut me out with the jaws of life and, you know, take me to the hospital. That itself was a life-changing experience. So that's what got me on that path, because after going through that, is when I had that talk with my grandfather and he was like, well, why don't we get you to the recruiter? You know, and I was like, no, there's no way that they're going to let me in at this point with all my, everything I have on my record. And he's like, well, let's just give it a shot.
Well, so you go in the military, you join, you finally get in, you go artillery, but then switch over to infantry. You figured out that you like those guys a lot better. First day at Camp Pendleton. Is it true that you were offered the sniper course the very first day you got to Camp Pendleton?
No, I was offered to go to sniper platoon. So it's to the NDOC, to the training. It's the course that they put on for you to get into the sniper platoon. So it's like their own little NDOC that they run at the unit level. The difference is that if you go to sniper school, you graduate sniper school, you're a sniper. If you get into the platoon and you're not a sniper, they call you a pig, professionally instructed gunman. And then if you're a hog, then you're a hunter of gunmen. And the reason why, it wasn't because I was this special guy that was coming in and they're like, whoa, this guy needs to be put into snipers. It was because the platoon or the unit that I went to was super tight and they had all just done an Iraq deployment. None of them wanted to leave that platoon. So they said, hey, we need three guys to go to the sniper NDOC. And they picked all new guys to go. And I think one senior guy, but it was me, you know what I mean? So I want to make it clear. It wasn't like I showed up and they were like, this guy's got it. We got to groom him for some big things.
Well, let me ask you though. I mean, that is a specialized platoon though. I mean, you got to admit it's got a little bit of flair to it, but you go there at a very young rank. Do you think that was good or bad for your career?
Both.
Okay.
I think just having that deeper level of gut check of, they call it thrashed, being thrashing or being thrashed, but it's essentially like having someone, because at boot camp, they do this to you too. If you get in trouble at Marine boot camp, they have what's called the quarter deck, and they bring you up and they're like, hey, Hall, they bring you up, come up here, and you start doing push-ups and then jumping jacks and then whatever, and you start breaking a sweat. And then they do that to you until they break you or they get tired or you have to go do something else, you know, or if they have, like now they have probably a time limit where they can only do it for this long. But in snipers, they got all day, every day. There's no time limit. They got you live there and they've got you right there. So this can go all day, every day, all week long, all month long. And so learning how to deal with, okay, you know, we had to go do this crazy hike, you know, with these packs and literally run the whole way to the top of the hill. And then when you get to the top, you got to run down and then go do it again. It's like, but going up was the hardest thing that you've ever done. And you got to just, but you got to just get, condition your mind to just let go of whatever it is. And just like literally just go one little bit at a time and just keep putting one foot in front of the other until it stops. And I think having those experiences and those, because it's like, I've never ran a full marathon before, but I've ran a half marathon and I've done these really long movements in the military where it's on foot and we've gone really long mileage. And it's like, until you've experienced that, you really can't read that in a book and download that and take that in, you know, you gotta do it. And then you're like, whoa, that is a straight gut check, you know, and you got to find all these new levels of yourself and also let your ego die in all these different ways, because I work with a lot of kids that are going into the military and a lot of them, they're studs. They look really sharp. They're in great shape. They always want to be at the very, very top. And I have to train it into them to be ready whenever you're at a point where you've been going for days or you get sick or you're doing something that you really suck at and you take last in that thing. You got to be ready to accept that and not quit in that moment.
So let me ask you then on that, not to interrupt you, but were you good at that? Because it doesn't seem like you would be very good at that to me back in that time period. When you came in last, when you got beat by everyone, when you couldn't figure out a way to compartmentalize it and move on, were you good at handling that?
I was good at handling it during the day. And okay. Then what would happen is, because I'm a young rank and everything in the military is a pack mentality. So you have all these high ranking people around you and they control pretty much your quality of life. So, you know, if someone yells at you or they do something where like on the street or out in the real world, it wouldn't be accepted between you and that person. But there it's accepted because you got the command in front of them. They got all this rank around them. So then they can yell at you and talk to you like that, and you just have to take it. And that's part of the Marines and that's part of the military with rank and how that shit works sometimes and a lot of the time. And so, you know, how it would play out is, you know, people yelling at me or telling me to get the fuck over here and clean the, sweep this shit over here. And it's like, what? And it's like, there's different way that you could have asked me to do that. You know, you don't need to talk to me like that. And just to be real, like in a real environment, you would never fucking talk to me like that. The only reason why you are is because you have that rank on that silly, stupid ass rank on your collar. But in a real life environment, dude, like you would never, ever be able to talk to me like that. So but it would get away during the day. And then at any time I would drink, that's when I would turn into Mr. Hyde. And I would, if those people were lived at the barracks or they lived on base with me in my little building, once I would have enough drinks, it would just be a matter of time before I would start to find one of those one of those individuals. And then it would, you know, sometimes I would, a lot of times I wouldn't get in trouble, but every now and then I would end up in major trouble.
All right, let's talk about a little of that trouble. At one point, you were kicked out of the sniper platoon, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes. And I've heard you say that you would drink so much that you would black out, and people would tell you, like, hey, you did this, and you'd be like, I don't even remember that. First off, how much do you think you were drinking at peak prime hall drinking?
Well, in the Marine Corps, it was astronomically more than any other time. But when I drank in the Marine Corps, because I ended up doing 10 years with no alcohol in the Marines, but my first 2 years I drank extremely heavily, it would be astronomical. Like, it would be like a case or what, like a bottle and beers and whatever, just like a shitload of drinking that was very excessive.
Was that in your family? Was because we didn't really talk about that. Was alcoholism in your family? Was there heavy drinking growing up? Do you remember that at all?
Yeah, there was. So my grandparents on my other side, that they're both passed away, I spent a lot of time with them whenever I was growing up as well. They were, my grandmother, Barbara, she was the swimmer that would always take me to the pool, and she was a hardcore alcoholic. And I had hardcore alcoholics on both sides of my family. I have alcoholism, but my grandma, Barb, was a serious alcoholic. And so I would see that play out on a weekly basis with some the craziest shit popping off at her house. And honestly, I loved it. And I would always want to spend the night at her house, because it would always be crazy, just like, you know, and she would break dishes sometimes, like, and do all this crazy shit. So my grandfather worked with, if you're familiar with HEB grocery stores in Texas.
Is anybody in Texas not familiar with HEB?
Yeah. So my grandfather, Ralph, was the head attorney for Howard Edward Butt, and they both retired when they both retired at the same time. So my grandfather retired as a young man, ended up like working as a city councilman and doing these kinds of things, but very well off, lived on the golf course. My grandma Barb loved to just shop every day and go to all the grocery stores and then come home at 5 o'clock and put on Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune was the two shows. And that's when she would start with the bourbon. And so she drank Evan Williams bourbon, would sit there and stir the drink right there with her finger. And she outlived my grandfather. And funny story is that she drank so much that when she ended up living by herself, they downsized her from living in that place on the golf course because she couldn't manage it, to living in a smaller condo that was just around the corner. And so when I would come home before my deployment, I would check in on her and then whenever I would be home, I would always hang out with her and stuff. So I went to her place, and it was just like the worst alcohol smell ever. And what it was is that we found her credit card and her bank statements and stuff. She was pulling out like almost a handle every day or every other day of Evan Williams from the liquor store. And just like, I was like, dude, my grandmother parties like a spring break person every single night of her life. And she literally, I didn't know how she did it, but yeah, she was awesome too. So I had that crazy excessive alcoholism and that stuff in front of me since I was, you know, little kid growing up.
Do you think that that affected you and your drinking, or do you think that that was just a thing that was in your past?
I think it affected me for sure, but it's also the culture of the Marine Corps. And even like, you know, my grandmother and grandfather, when I graduated boot camp, they came to boot camp and took me to Vegas from San Diego. From Marine Corps boot camp, we went to Vegas and partied for 3 days and then went to Texas, and I got a week off, and then I went back and went to infantry school. Getting out of boot camp for 3 months, I'm locked up, we go straight to Vegas. It's like huge party. And when I showed up in Vegas, was a funny story, because I'm still in whatever the uniform that you graduate in.
Right.
But I have one ribbon on. So it's just whatever ribbon that you get, the National Defense ribbon. you know, so
thanks for joining the military, Ruben.
Right. And so I got people in Vegas that are hammered drunk that are buying drinks for me, telling me thank you for like, for going over there and doing all of that. And like just all that crazy shit. And you just like, I never experienced any of that before. So, but I ended up the night just with, you know, my uniform all messed up and just hammered and whatever else. And then the next day, and while I was in Vegas, I actually came into a security job because when I was in military school, I had a lot of my friends that were from Monterrey, Mexico. So a lot of time on our leave or on vacation, I would go back to Monterrey, to the area that they're from, which is San Pedro, which is the wealthy area. And we would have these crazy experiences with their bodyguards and them taking us out and all the being in bulletproof cars and like dealing with all that because there's kidnappings and stuff like that. And sometimes right. It's bad, sometimes it's not, but it's always there.
We've talked about you getting in a little bit of trouble, but it kind of culminates and ends up on this 31st. You're with 31st MEU for a year. It's a training deployment. And the Marines are kind of done and they're ready to boot you. Let's talk about what caused that, what led up to it, and then how you turned it around from there.
So my first deployment was that for year-long MEU, but before the deployment, I had gotten in huge trouble and lost all my rank and got completely maxed out, as they call it, put on restriction and all of that for an alcohol-related incident that involved the police out in Oceanside, detained me, and then took me to the main gate and dropped me off with the MPs. And at that point, I was still resistant. When the staff duty came to get me, this is what I ended up getting in the most trouble for, was disrespecting and whatever I did to that staff duty that was in charge that came to pick me up. God knows what, you know, the whatever that I did, because when I would get into that mode, it was like revolt against all authority kind of mindset. And so when the cops rolled me up in Oceanside at that time, I remember that they're like, are you good? You good? You good? And I was like, yeah, I'm good. And then I would start to do all that stuff again. And then they would have to take me down. And so that was I'm just saying that. I'm not saying any of that for any reason other than just to explain that I was in a bad place. And I don't think I've mentioned it. I know we haven't mentioned it, but I had a situation that this is why I was getting in a lot of trouble in the military at a young age, was because when I was in sniper platoon, my stepmom had died in a car accident and she got hit by a drunk driver. And so it happened, you know, overnight. And then now they're planning the funeral. And I got a Red Cross message to come home. So I was going to fly home from Camp Pendleton. And then they ended up blocking me from going home to the funeral. But not just blocking me from going home, but pretending like they were going to send me home. And then acting like they couldn't send me home because I needed to be there for this training that was absolute bullshit. So they played this whole mind trick game on me. This was my captain that was in charge of the sniper platoon at the time. He ended up getting relieved of his duties and removed from his job. That guy played this whole trick on me and then acted like I was, you know, had me get all ready to go to the airport to go home to my stepmom's funeral, and then had me go put my uniform back on and go out for training for the rest of the day after that, and like played this whole fucking thing. So when that happened, I was flipped a switch inside of me that was like, absolutely fuck everybody in charge of this whole thing. I'm not here. I'm not on anybody's team here, and I don't give a shit about any of these people. So there were a few cool people and people that I'm still in contact with that were back from that sniper platoon. But at the time, that single event did it for me, and I was over it.
Here we go again, and this is exactly what I'm talking about. So you're at this point where you say, fuck all these people. This isn't my team. This isn't anything. And then you stop drinking, and you go to Marine Special Operations, and you turn over a whole new leaf, and you do all these great things while you're there. I'm trying to understand it. These switches keep getting flipped back and forth. What do you think it is that made him go so drastic? Because I think you would agree, Prime, those are pretty drastic measures from fuck this team to special operations.
Right. No, it is. And it's kind of interesting how the special operations thing came, because, and I never got into the Marines and thought that I was going to do 20 years. I imagined that scenario at certain points, but I always just took it 4 years at a time and then reassessed at the end of 4 years. But at the end of my first 4 years, so in my first 2 years, complete screw up, almost got kicked out. My next 2 years, completely performed off the charts, got meritoriously promoted all the way back up. So I caught up to all my peers after losing my rank those times. Now I'm all the way caught up. I'm getting meritoriously promoted. I'm in a leadership position. And the training that I was doing, and the reason why they were promoting me, is because I was on a different level than a lot of the other people that were there in different ways. And I would do things like, you know, after we would wake up at 5:30, go run, go do whatever workout we're as infantry Marines that they have us do, go do a hike, go hike the mountains of Camp Pendleton, do all this stuff, then come back, do whatever classes and training and shooting. And then at the end of the day, after we were turning weapons, I would drive an hour down to La Jolla and work out with a trainer for 6 hours, and then drive back to Camp Pendleton, and then only get a couple hours of sleep, and then do it and come back at times where everybody else goes back and just completely crashes, because the hike that we just did, that was the 20K hike or whatever, was just so grueling. And as soon as we come back, I just shower, head down to La Jolla, and go do all my different workouts, because I had a mental focus trainer that I had gotten into contact with that lived in La Jolla. That I was, once I got sober and I stopped drinking, I became obsessed with pushing the edge of training, both mentally and physically, to see what I was capable of. And so I got into that even at the end of Okinawa when I was out there for my first deployment. I got into killer shape my last couple months out there of just running, doing weighted runs, doing like even in the heat out there, doing all kinds of shit, pack runs. And I was doing more pull-ups, more push-ups, more everything. I had dropped down and was just completely at my fighting weight, because I've been on restriction for so long. I had nothing else to do but, you know, get into good shape. I've pretty much been on restriction for 2 years, and I'm grateful for all of that. And being on restriction sucks. And even for 60 days is what a maxed out restriction is. So 2 months is maxed out, like for fully getting non-judicial punishment. And I was in that for 2 years only because in Okinawa, they have liberty restriction. So if you're someone that they decide you're a liberty risk, which I was, then they put you on liberty risk. And the liberty risk that I was on, I had to check in every 2 hours, just like it was when I was on restriction. So any time that we were not working, I had to check in with my little folder and my timesheet, and go to the thing and check in every 2 hours. So if you can imagine you're checking in every 2 hours, how much peace or anything are you going to do in between those other 2 hours when you've got to walk 30 minutes or 15 minutes each way to get to where you need to get your signature? It's just like little shit like that. So what you do in those times, hopefully, is it's just like a prisoner. You find yard time. You can only go to the gym and go to the cafeteria and check in. What else are you going to do?
Yeah.
At a certain point, you got to start to hit the pull-up bar or do some bench press or something, or else you're going to lose your absolute mind.
Yeah. Do you think you got close to that?
Oh yeah. I remember just, you know, having these breakdowns and stuff because we would leave Okinawa and then go to another training where we would be in the Philippines out in the field for a month. And then we would be in South Korea in the wintertime, living in a fighting hole for a month, and it's freezing. And so the whole time you're questioning your whole existence. And for me, I'm on restriction and all this shit, and I'm just thinking like, what the fuck am I doing? Like, what is this? What is the, you know, cause this is not it for me. And to make it clear, what I really learned and noticed about myself and why I didn't work well in that conventional Marine Corps setting, which I never did, but I did fine. Once I got into MARSOC and Raiders, for the most part, I didn't have any issues at all for the most part. But that's because it's more outside the box and it's more of a merit-based environment than a bureaucratic bullshit. Oh, well, why do we do this? Well, we do this because this is why ever we've always done this. And this is why we do it, because that guy that has more rank and he said that that's how we do it. He has more rank, but that's the guy that's never been to Iraq before. And all these guys with less rank, they've been three times and they're saying that that's not what we should do. So why would we listen to that guy that has more rank, that's never been here before, that's literally the probably dangerous to us with the information that he's, and the planning that he's trying to come up with? Right?
Right. I mean, you see it in a lot of different things. The question that I have with you about MARSOC, though, is you're going to the utmost level. You said it's outside the box thinking, which fits you very well. But I think another thing that it is about you is it's that gut check, that thing that makes you be the best. It doesn't ask you to be the best. It makes you be the best at what you're doing. Do you think that's why you excelled so much in it? Because that's another time where it's pretty much an individual sport, don't you think, for a while you're going over to the Raiders?
It is at times, but the whole time you're surrounded by amazing guys.
But it's on you to gut check yourself, correct?
Yes. Yes. You have to prepare yourself and get ready for all of it, mentally, physically, psychologically, because you're going to be tested on all those angles. It's not, and it's going to be a deep, you're going to get deep psychological evaluation and all types of shit while you're out there. So you got to be, you got to be prepped. And some people that don't prep, they miraculously just pull it off. And then they're, you know, that's just part of who they are. But there's people that go to BUDS, for example, and I've found this out and heard this recently, that go to BUDS almost every class at Navy SEAL training that have never been in the ocean before, that pass. And they're like, dude, how did you, at the end of it, how did you get ready for this? And they're like, I trained in the lake where I'm from, or I did this thing, and you know, I've been doing that for this many years, and it was fine.
But there's still preparation there. It might not be the ocean, but there's definitely still preparation there. Getting your mindset ready to know. And I think with you, when you explained about your childhood, about getting hit, let's go back to that real quick, where you said, I know by my dad hitting me, by the second hit, I won't feel it anymore. Don't you think that's what helped you out in this training right here? Was you were like, I know this sucks, but at a certain point, it's going to suck so bad that it's not, I'm just going to become numb to it.
Yes. And I had learned about that too in the mental focus training that I did, because I learned how to just turn my mind off to a completely different level and just continue to go for long periods of time for whatever training that guy would put me through. He put me through some different types of things that were extremely challenging.
All right, let's talk about you as a MARSOC Raider. I want to talk about before your first combat deployment as a Raider. I want to know your mind state, what you're thinking about as you move through them, and then we're going to talk about two specific dates in your career.
So as I was getting ready for Afghanistan, I had already been to Iraq, some combat, but that was the end of the Iraq war. And so it wasn't the combat that a lot of other Marines had seen and dealt with in that area, in Ramadi and around the Syrian border and throughout all of Iraq. So it was a little different. So there was still people getting killed. There was still gunfire and rockets and all that kind of stuff, but it's very here and there. We were turning everything over to the Iraqis. So it was very, we were on guard, but we were also giving everything away at the same time. So it's interesting, like, you know, having a base that's secured one day to where it's, you gave it away and it's not secure the next day in that moment that you're that, right. that it's going from being a completely secured facility to you to it not is an interesting moment. But so we were dealing with all the EPWs and the prisoners that were the high level ones that were being rerouted to different areas of Iraq at the end of the war and all that stuff, and kind of strange, but it felt like a training deployment. But getting ready for Afghanistan, I knew because there were so many casualties and we were getting all of the reports on what the teams were dealing with that we were replacing. And we were getting reports like weeks out that the team that we were going in to replace with my team had gone out for a patrol in the new area that they had just gotten dropped into that we were going to be replacing them in, the new village, and that they had went out for their first patrol and got completely surrounded and had to bound back to their base. And so we were getting shit like that. And I was like, what? Like, that sounds horrible. And that's where we're going to live for 7 months. And these guys can't even go out on one patrol. And they've lived out there for 7 months in that area. And they, it's just whatever that your mind is. Your mind's a survival mechanism. So you start to work all these weird scenarios in your head. But my mind was going off because I was a new guy also. So I wanted to prove myself. I wanted to be an asset. And it's a crazy experience to go through, but it's just a process because so many people do it and have done it. But just to talk you through it, I lived in California. I was at Camp Pendleton at 1st Raider Battalion. I lived in an apartment with a roommate that was a Raider out in town. You know, we had a two-bedroom apartment, and we live in a first world country, and we live in California. We go to all these cool places. We always have fun on the weekends, do all this stuff. Now we turn our apartment in. We know we've been training for Afghanistan. We turn our apartment in. Now we're like a week out from going. Now we're living in now we go on leave back home. We write our will. You prepare all your stuff like you might not make it home. And so you really are prepared in a lot of ways to just be present out there and do whatever you need to do to protect everybody around you and make it home, I feel like, in a lot of ways. And so, but I was also, to be honest, just wondering what it was going to be like and trying to prepare myself as much as possible. It's kind of probably like someone going to prison for the first time.
Well, here's the thing about that. Do you think that it hurt you or helped you that you did quote unquote big Marines over in Iraq before you were MARSOC over in Afghanistan? Do you think that helped or hurt you? Because I have a feeling that it hurt you more than it helped.
I mean, I can't say that every experience I feel like I've learned from, but what the Iraq experience did for me the most was it gave me the motivation and the drive and the inner resolve to never, ever, ever be in an infantry unit again, ever.
Okay.
And to get out of there and go into special operations. I thought I was going to force recon. So I had a recon contract initially that I was going to recon training. That ended up getting switched with the company commander that I had a roommate in college that ended up going to MARSOC, replacing him in Afghanistan. So he was like, hey, my roommate went to MARSOC and he loves it there. I think that, you know, that would be a better fit for you. And so instead of recon, if you're open to it, I'm going to get you connected so you can get a MARSOC screening. So I went for it. And the thing was, though, is that I got all my MARSOC screening stuff checked off to where I was going to go to selection when I got back from Iraq. But when I was in Iraq, my first 4 years was closing out and I was about to be at the end of my enlistment. So I needed to reenlist, which if you reenlist overseas, you get in Iraq or Afghanistan or in a war zone, you get a tax-free reenlistment bonus. And so that's cool. But when I put my reenlistment in, they denied my reenlistment because of my punishments that I had. And so I literally had to break my chain of command and find my old first sergeant that was the sergeant major then that worked with the guy that had non-recommended me, the colonel. And I was like, hey, sergeant major, like, remember me? because he had been there. He'd been my first sergeant when I had gotten maxed out on in Okinawa, and his name was Slattery, and so he was a sergeant major. Then I found him on the street in Iraq at Camp Al Assad, and said, "Hey, look at me. Like, you remember what happened and how I was a couple years ago, and look at everything that I've done since. And now, as soon as I go back, I'm doing this. And this is everything that I've been up to since I got in trouble. And like, can you give me one chance and have the colonel sign my paperwork so I can reenlist?" And I was not, I'm saying this because I was breaking my chain of command, because I wasn't allowed to go talk to him or anybody outside of my little, the next one up in my chain. That's the only one you're allowed to. So if I would have just stayed there and not, and followed the rules, I would have not been able to reenlist or go forward or do shit. So, thankfully,
that's that resourcefulness.
It came into play, but you have to just do whatever it takes sometimes to get the job done.
With all of the things that you dealt with big Marines or, you know, regular Marines before you go over to MARSOC, and you see this new kind of lifestyle, once you get on the deployment into Afghanistan with this group, is it a completely different, I guess you would say, battle space to you, a different war to you because of what you're doing? Because you were on village stability operations, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So is it, when you get there, are you like, okay, now this is what I can deal with for 20 years or whatever?
Oh man, getting over there, it's humans, I feel like, can adapt to anything, and it's an adaptation experience, because you get over there, the first night that I was there, one of the Afghan local police stepped on an IED and lost both of his legs. And then within the next couple of days, we're getting attacked. You know, this is within the first week. We were replacing the team that had been there for 7 months. So at that time, you know, I feel like a fish out of water. You know, all these guys have beards. I got like a 2 day in beard, you know, like a couple little speck. And, I'm like loading my magazine. I'm like loading my magazines, and rounds are falling on the ground and stuff. And I'm like, you know, living with the interpreters. It's not like the movies where, you know, it's all cool and everything's whatever. It's really just trying to find your footing and find where you're going to be, get all the information that you can from the individuals that have been there for 7 months. I mean, always have your notepad out, asking questions, getting any type of advice on, you know, what worked with working with the Afghans, what, you know, what to look out for, where are all the enemy, you know, locations, where's all of the things that you would want, you know, that we would need to know, and really pick everybody's brain from the bottom of the team to the top of the team and back down, and every position in between, intel guys, support guys of any kind, asking any possible thing that you can to gain information on that environment, so that you can understand what the operational environment is. Because this is a place where in the middle of the day, if you put your hand above the wall like this, or you get on top of one of the vehicles to look at a serial number or to dust off the machine gun or do something like that, they're going to start to shoot at you. If you expose yourself in any way during the daytime in our area, you're going to get shot. And
yeah,
so,
'cause you lived actually in an enemy village, correct?
Yeah, my team lived in a place called Watan, Mermandab in Watan in Helmand Valley, Afghanistan, which was a spot that was right on, it was a village that was right on the Helmand River, and it flowed right along a canal as well. So we had the canal and the river, and that was like brought in all the fighters with those around the canal and the river and all of the fighting beds that were around us. We were in it pretty much every day that we were there until the very end of deployment. Whenever the leaves start to fall off and the vegetation kind of dies away, the fighting dies down too at the end of the year. So the last month or so it died down, but we still got some really heavy attacks. I was just talking about this last week because we had an anniversary of June 14th. So, but I have a funny story from Afghanistan about some NCIS guys.
Okay.
That came out to investigate us for morphine that went missing. And then we ended up getting attacked really bad. And so can I bring that up now, or do you want to?
No, absolutely. We're going to talk about that. That was actually the next thing was June 14th. But it's up to you. Do you want to set up that day, or do you want to talk about what you wanted to and then just kind of flow into that?
Yeah, so I could talk about June 14th and that we just had the anniversary of June 14th last week, but it's been 11 years. On the morning or the night before, we had gotten called out to support an Army Special Forces mission. So we were going to set up a blocking position in a compound and be a support element for these Green Berets that had a mission going out there that we're going to likely have a lot of Taliban moving through their position towards us or us to them. So we went out to set up a support element. And in the early morning hours, the Army SF guys stepped on an IED and had to return back to base. So we ended up in this compound in a village that we hadn't been to before. And we patrolled out there. So we walking out there in the middle of the night, we're on night vision. We're walking through a minefield the whole time. There's IEDs everywhere that we're navigating around, you know, moving around and marking and dealing with and bypassing and all this different stuff to get to this compound. We take it over. The whole time you're gaining atmospherics in different ways. Through the radios, through the different intelligence that's coming in, you're getting atmospherics of what the local radio chatter that's going on in the village and what the bad guys are saying. And so you can pretty quickly, once you start to use all those tools, you can quickly paint a picture of what's happening around you. And then you'll start to hear things that confirm what you just heard the bad guys say. Because, okay, here, we're going to bring you the supplies. Don't worry, brother. And that's what they're saying on the radio. And then you hear the motorcycle take off and it's like, and they're like, coming to you. Or, you know, it's like, okay, it's all makes sense. But we would hear them, you know, looking for us and saying they think that they know that we landed, or they know that we're in their village. They know that we're here and they're looking for what building that we're in. Are we in the building with the blue gate? Are we in the building by the water? Are we in the building? Da, da, da. And they're frantic running around and they're on the radios and you can hear them, what they're saying. And we're getting the interpreters are telling us word for word what's happening, right? And so you're getting the picture of what's happening around you. Sometimes it's way worse than others. And this day it was really bad as to what was forming up around us, to the point that we had to leave and half of us go out into the tree line and set up another position in case this first position gets overran and so we could support. And so half of us went out into the tree line before the sun came up. And when the sun came up, we got surrounded on all sides. And the building that our teammates were in got surrounded. And us in the tree line got surrounded on all sides. And before that, it was really, we knew that what was happening because we could see individuals that were behind the buildings that were peeking out at us from like this and then going back and hiding. So your spidey senses and all that stuff at that point, we had been in Afghanistan for a few months and we had been on some missions and had some dealt with some, you know, situations. And so this was by far the worst situation that we had been in at that point and likely the worst one that we were in just because we were off base. You know, we were out of our little compound. We were out of our village. We were way out of our village and we were, you know, cut off and surrounded. And so
I read did they outnumber you like 7 to 8 times the number of guys you had there? The enemy had that many?
I don't know the exact numbers, but it was a lot of enemy combatants that were coming at us and enveloping us. Once they knew that we had wounded teammates and once we got them out on the first, once we evac'd our two teammates that got shot, after that, it got worse throughout the day. Like the aircraft, thank God that we had the aircraft on station throughout the day because the aircraft can paint the picture to the JTACs and the guys on the ground that are controlling the airstrikes. They can paint the picture the whole time and confirm that, you know, there's 15 armed individuals or there's this many armed individuals that's running to your position from this, you know, at this direction, at this location, all of them are armed. you know, confirmed, and they can deal with that threat. Because when you're inside of a compound, you cannot you cannot expose yourself and like look over the wall and go, what's going on out there? Right. So you have to fight from behind right. what we call a murder hole, or a hole that we use a sledge or a pick, and we pick all the way through these wooden compounds that they have out there in Afghanistan, and we put a hole through it that we could shoot through. But even those holes, like your vantage point and your sight picture that you get through that thing is very limited. So sometimes at the very best, it just keeps people's heads back, or keeps people's heads down, or keeps them from moving up on you. But you're not really doing, like, it's very hard to secure everything without having an overhead overwatch. You're inside of a compound during the day. You if anything that gets exposed turns into a pumpkin.
Right. Well, the first two, you said the first two that got evacuated, that was the team leader and another Marine that were almost immediately wounded when you fell under attack. Is that correct? The team leader and another Marine?
Yes. Yeah. So my team leader, Derek Herrera, and then one of my best friends, and then another one of my best friends, Ricky Breer, was also wounded. He was shot through and through the neck, and Derek was shot in the back and paralyzed from the chest down.
Can we talk about what your thoughts are? We've talked a lot through this conversation about being in that right mind state and stuff. When this is happening, I'm guessing even through all the fighting that you'd been through, I've seen you say this was the craziest day of your life. How do you get that mind state, that one that has helped you so much with everything that's going on around you? How do you fight through it mentally?
With teammates and buddies. I remember my buddy Hafiz was with me pretty much throughout the whole day, and Hafiz lived with me. We both lived because we had two sites within the village. One was the main team site, and then one was a small compound that was a logistics compound that me, and all of them were fortified with security posts and everything, but the smaller one was where me and only a couple of raiders of my teammates lived, and one of them was Hafiz. And so we had been prepared for the mission, because we had a lot of the logistics were at our location. So we had been up for 2 days for 1 day when we started that mission. So it felt like we were up for 2 days. And then by the time we had evac'd our two teammates, I remember we asked each other what time it was. We thought it was like 5 PM or something like that. And it was like 8:30 in the morning. And we were like, no, oh my gosh, dude. We had already, or, you know, maybe 9 a.m. or something like that. We're like, oh my gosh, dude. Like literally we felt like we really believed that it was late, that so much had expired, had happened that day, that it was in the afternoon. And it was just early in the morning. So that whole day was the longest, felt like the longest day. And some of the situations that played out with the Afghans and just all of it, from the heroism that I saw from people displayed on that day was unlike anything that I've ever seen in my life, to include the Afghans doing some straight Medal of Honor type shit. I never saw anything like it. And I never saw the Afghans ever perform like that at any other time on that deployment. To paint the picture, whenever we ran out into the field to evac them, we had to blow a hole into the wall because there's bombs in all the doorways. You can't move through normal doorways in those villages. They're all rigged to blow. So we have to get into these compounds using ladders and stuff like that. And then we get in and carefully move around and mark all of the bombs and stay away from them while we're in there. And so for this, we had to blow a hole because we had to use a field on the other side of the compound to extract them. So once we blew a hole, the enemy started shooting towards that hole and into the hole, basically where our team was running out to do the extract. So
that's a fatal funnel. I mean, it's definitely a fatal funnel.
Yeah. It was a big ass hole that our team blew out of the wall. So they had a pretty decent sized target. When we came out, it was like full adrenaline, you know, everything you got just kind of hyping yourself up to run through that thing. Me and the Afghans ran out first to set up the security element, and then our teams and some, and even one of the Terps and everybody else carried the two stretchers out with our two teammates and got them on the helicopters and then got back in the compound. So all that we needed to do was get out and spread out and start to lay down fire into all the shooting positions, into the tree line as much as possible, so that the helicopters could land and that the teammates could come in. So when we ran out, before we ran out, the Afghans basically told me that they were all in and that they were like, whatever differences that we had, that they were like, they were going to work with us until we got out of the, and they were in to work through this situation. Basically, like, all the bullshit was over and, you know, let's get to work. So that was different, because normally they were not like that at all. They just complained all the time, never wanted to do anything. And now they were like, all right, hey, all that's over. Like, all the bullshit that we normally do is over and we're here now. And I'm like, all right, look. So when we get out there, the only thing is we cannot bunch up. We need so many on this side and so many on this side so the helicopters can land in the middle. And the only thing is we can't bunch up. So I saw, you know, some of those Afghan local police guys that, you know, were doing Medal of Honor runs, being shot at and getting up and doing what I said when I was telling them to move and tell them to shift and move and get and go further out so they weren't bunching up. And they were literally getting up with rounds being shot all around them and moving and doing exactly what I was telling them in some ways. But really the whole point was, is they were doing whatever they needed to do for the survivability of us as a group. And it was insane to watch that whole thing play out. And so everybody survived that night. A lot of us got replaced by a SEAL platoon. Dan Crenshaw was in there, and that's where he lost his eye. That's a politician from Texas. Crazy experience. And then we went back. So I got helo extracted back to my little compound and dropped off like in the watermelon patch outside of my compound and walked in the middle of the night. And then, you know, after that, we still had about 4 or 5 months of deployment left, or I think 4 months left. So at that point, I was probably thinking, how the hell are we going to survive?
And that's exactly what I was going to ask you was, does this harden your stance and say, like, you know, you're doing the right thing? Or are you thinking, like, how the fuck am I going to keep this going?
Exactly. I'm thinking, how are we all going to survive this being out here? And the more that I look back, the more that I find that I coped out there by making it like a comedy in any way that I could, and just laughing about the craziest shit that would happen, and just kind of making it like a comic relief, how insane that it was out there, and really making the most out of it too. I mean, so one of my jobs was Afghan local police. So I had at least 60 Afghan local police at all times that I worked with, and it was mainly my job. So it was me and them. And I equipped them with weapons and ammo and trucks and food and training and all this different stuff. And it was a crazy experience. And I paid them. Those guys, I took care of my guys, and they would hook me up and they would bring me an Afghan mountain coochie dog, one of the really special dogs, mountain dogs that they have in Afghanistan. And I got to bring it home to Texas and it ended up living in Texas for 10 years after I brought it home from Afghanistan. But they would bring me pigeons as pets. They would bring me all this stuff, and they were a bunch of wild characters. So I would have fun when I would have my meetings, you know, with the interpreters and the Afghans, and make it as much as I could, I guess, make the most out of it in certain ways, and make it a reality show, I guess, is kind of like the coping mechanism that I use. But there were missions that happened and things that happened, you know, teammates that do funny stuff, and then people that are there that have no business being there, that do shit that's just like keeps it comical for everybody, and keeps things it keeps things moving for me. You know, when these little funny things are happening, or these people have these little breakdowns over stupid shit, and it just keeps it, you know, it keeps it fun in certain ways. So I think I use that, but there was always something going on almost every day. So there was never a shortage of crazy, wild shit going on.
Did you journal a lot of it?
No, I did.
I don't know why you got to laugh like that. I'm just wondering.
No. I laughed just because, I don't know why, but I did through photography, because I had my,
even my little
cameras that I would do like my training and stuff. You know, I took a lot of pictures of different things, and I feel like I documented it well while I was there, thankfully. But so I kind of did, but I think that I have journaled so much since I've been out, or since that experience, because a lot of it has been stuff that I didn't want to deal with, or I didn't want to think about. I would try to avoid those memories, and avoid all of this conversation about it. And avoid all those pictures and all that stuff. So now I've been working through all these different means to open up and lean in and approach all of those things in any way that happened, and learn from them and use them as much as possible for positive as much as I can.
I'm glad you said that, because the other date that I want to talk about is the date that you get out of the Marines. If you can explain why you got out, you were medically discharged from the Marines, but the day you get out, we've talked about your whole life, drive without purpose. And now, especially after you've been with MARSOC, been in combat zones, done all these amazing things, you get out and you're kind of back there without purpose. And you've posted on your Instagram, you posted one, an article from Sean Snow that talked about MARSOC and the tab that it left after 13 years, 43 deaths, 300 Valor Awards, over 300 operations. And you talked about, we'd never leave a man down, but now that the war is over, we're leaving a lot of things unturned. How did you feel getting out after all that you did and not having that purpose again?
It's definitely shedding your identity and losing your identity as what you thought that was what made you who you are, was that you're a MARSOC. I was a MARSOC Raider. I was an operator. I was an operations chief. I was a level 3 intel guy, been to all these courses, blah, 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 blah. And then going from that to, yeah, you're nothing. You're a liability. That's why you're on a medical hold. So that's why you go to all the medical appointments. So it doesn't really matter. You're not an operator anymore. So yeah, figure out what you're going to do when you get out. So then that is like a gut check right there. That's a blessing in disguise, because I really want to, I'm glad that that happened to me that way, because I needed to lose that identity and then kind of come back to it in some ways. Because when I got out, I didn't accept any of that identity as a military veteran or any of that stuff. And any time that I would be anywhere where they would recognize you as a veteran, or, hey, please stand up and be recognized, I would always never accept that type of stuff or receive anything like that. And I just wanted to get far, far away from any of my military stuff when I got out. But I also had a miracle happen in that I met my wife. And so I had my wife and my son when I got out of the military. And that was the thing, that I had met her the year that I was getting out, or the year before I got out, to have that, because I never had when I was in the military, I never had a serious relationship.
Can I ask you, why didn't you ever stand up? Why did you try and shed that identity so much? I get what you're saying is that you can't make it who you are once you get out. But why try and bury it away so much?
It's not good. It's not good to bury it, I've learned. But I think, well, looking back, because of thinking that I could avoid it and being in an avoidance-based coping, which is now what I can kind of look back and recognize it as avoidance. But then that only works until it doesn't work anymore. And then you have to deal with your problems and approach them. And so over time, I've been, I guess, lucky enough to hit kind of rock bottom or mental breakdown at certain points and then be able to, okay, I can't continue with the way that I've been doing. So something has to change. So I got to look at everything possible and what I can do differently, because obviously I don't know shit, because it's gotten me here to complete breakdown. So I'm open to anything that can possibly. So I've been able to kind of reframe and rework a lot of the way that I don't know, deal with things and whatever. But the biggest thing that I was when I got out, and I started drinking again too. So I went from not drinking for 10 years in the Marines to then drinking again when I got out and got into business school, because I have social anxiety and I didn't want to be sober around everyone in my class for 2 years. So I coped by drinking, and then in turn, I also was avoiding a lot of my problems and just getting hammered.
Did it ever come, because you talk a lot about suicide, and at one point you lost like 4 friends to suicide over a year's time period. It might have been even more than that. In this time period that you're growing, changing into this new person, is it ever a thought?
I would be lying if I said that it wasn't a thought, but it's not like I have the ideation or anything about it, but I have had very low points in suicidal, I guess you would call it, tendencies and ideation back 2 years after I got out. I had a really bad depression and had stopped taking all my medication and had been on antidepressants for at least a year or more, and then stopped taking everything and then just rode it out for about a year, and ended up having some really challenging times. I've been through a lot with that, and then worked with a lot of individuals since I've had those challenges and kind of been able to break through them on a lot of levels. Been able to work with a lot of other individuals with, I guess, helping them transition and deal and move through different parts of healing process.
What do you think it was that got you through it that so many other people struggle and just can't get over that hurdle? Because I've heard a lot of guys on this show say that they felt like, once again, that they just lost purpose, and that was what it was. Why do you think, or how do you think you got around that, where these other guys can't quite get past that?
For me, it was my family and having my wife and my kids. And then I really believe that in God, and having just the grace of God and being saved from these near-death experiences. I mean, another one was, I was in an insider attack in Afghanistan and got hit multiple times in close proximity with rocket propelled grenades. Luckily I was out in the open. So that was in August of 2012, but I've had these crazy experiences where I, a lot of the breakdown at points would have survivor's guilt, or I'd think about, well, it doesn't even make sense that I would live through that blast or that experience or these things, but it doesn't make sense that I would live through that car accident or that the vehicle would, you know, or any of these things. It just doesn't make sense over and over and over and over again to be shot so many times, still be walking around, or be shot at so many times and not have all those bullets, you know, impact me in different ways and whatever else that I've miraculously been through, that I'm really just very grateful. And my wife and my support system is my wife and my 2 kids. And I have a lot of different support from friends to coaches and mentors and advisors and just people that look out for me, and all different types of people that are in my circle that mean a lot to me, that add to my purpose in life.
Let's talk about that support circle with your kids and your wife. How do you think that you're a different father and a different parent from what your parents were, and what did you take from them in order to make you the parent that you are? Because I think we all try to be, as parents, better than ours were, and we hope that that travels forward in every generation. So what do you think that you've done to be that different father, to be that different parent, and to be that different husband?
Wow. My parents are really just great. It's been, gave me a lot of great lessons and gave me a case study on a lot of things that I would like to do differently. And so, and I've gotten to do differently and break the cycle on certain things. So I'll never be abusive with my kids. I would never allow for my kids to have a peeping Tom or something like anything like that. Not even for a few days or anything like that. That shit would be completely over with. I would never abandon my kids because of those experiences that I got to go through. It really has strengthened me and gives me just standards that I put on myself as a parent, what I'm willing to do for my kids. And I often tell people that if I wanted a strong why that I have is my kids now, today. If you want to get me to get up and do something, you know, make it about my kids, and that'll really get me going. But that at the same time, if someone were to mess with my kids or something, that would be when you would see the different side of who I am or what that would be like. So I love, and even my parents, I'm grateful for what they did, but it really shaped me in as a parent. And then with my relationship with my wife, it's that my parents got divorced when I was young, and that's why I was always afraid to have a serious relationship, because I never wanted to deal with being married or being divorced and all that stuff. But being with my wife, what my parents taught me is to find someone and then build your relationship so that you never get divorced. So I definitely am in that spot now where I think that maybe if my parents had a perfect marriage, that maybe I would have been the cycle that got divorced and had all these things. So I can't really sit back and say that I'm great because I'm doing all these things. I just had this experience and I'm trying to do something different.
When you say that and you talk about your parents, and you said that when you said why you're different than them, it's crazy that you bring up the words like abandonment and I would never do this and I would never do that. And so I have to ask you, other than what you've done with your family, how do you take it upon yourself after all that stuff happens, after so much heartache and turmoil and everything happens? How do you forgive them for that? And how do you, you know, kind of move on and have the relationship that you have with them now?
It's been a crazy journey. After the Marine Corps, I didn't talk to either of my parents at all for a couple years. And when I started to go to my first different treatments for traumatic brain injury and whatever psych stuff that I had, a lot of the memories were coming back from the childhood. And I was starting to, now that I have kids, and at that time, I think my son was like around 7, that I was starting to put all this together and be like, wait, how did I have this childhood? Like, now I see what childhood is supposed to look like and how parenting is supposed to be. How did this shit happen to me? And I started to go into this rabbit hole of questioning, like, no, what the fuck? No way. Like, how is that acceptable that this was the way that my shit worked out? And so I completely turned both of my parents' communication off. I went down that downward spiral getting out after 2 years. And then when I went to my first DMT healing ceremony for psychedelic assisted therapy is what I'm talking about, which took me about 6 months to get in because I was resisting it and I didn't want to go. But when I finally went, the transformation point, and when I was in those experiences, I had whatever things that I experienced when I was in that healing ceremony that told me that I needed to reconnect with my family. And I was also disconnected from my sister, who's my only sibling. And so when I got back from those ceremonies, I connected with both my parents and went and met them in person and basically had like a clear off with them where, you know, I held them accountable for whatever was bothering me about it, made peace with them and a truce to move forward. So we've been cool ever since. And, you know, it's not like a perfect relationship, but.
Is there any perfect relationship with a parent? I don't think there is. All right. Let's talk about what you're doing now, man. You've got this Underwater Torpedo League. You've got your book, Free Your Mind, the handbook. You have Deep End Fitness. I mean, like you're doing everything, man. You're making the podcast tours. You're just becoming like a certified celebrity. Well, if they turn your Underwater Torpedo League into an Olympic sport, that's it. You're done. You can retire and say that you lived a good life. You made an Olympic sport. So let's talk about the Underwater Torpedo League. And I want to ask you, with that Torpedo League and with what you're doing with the Free Your Mind handbook and the Deep End training, is that an alternative therapy? We just talked about your DMT, but is that also an alternative therapy that has really kept you on track?
Yes. Yeah, it's awesome because anytime that we go underwater, we go into a survival situation in our mind and we're cut off from our air source. So we go through the mammalian dive response is what it's called, but it's a psychological response that puts us into a survival situation and experience. And the beauty of that is, and people get it more and more now, but the beauty of that is that we have all this first world problems and bullshit that's going on day to day and week to week in our life. And then now we go in and we put ourselves underwater and we do these things and we intentionally put ourselves in a situation that induces anxiety and panic, and we just become comfortable in that, then we can turn off. When we're in there and we're underwater, we are in a survival situation in our mind. So it turns off and helps to turn off all those other things that we're thinking about that don't matter, which is awesome. So it quiets all that extra external noise. It's therapeutic for a lot of reasons. And it's also, there's an amazing community behind it now between both the league and Deep End Fitness that has been really the core of and brought a lot of purpose to what we're doing. So the both of them are almost 6 years old, and for the last like almost 5 years, we've had people that, you know, move from the East Coast out to California to come be part of the league, or people that have started programs. Now we have 22 Deep End Fitness locations across the United States in key cities. So there's just people getting involved like more and more now that we've started the expansion program. But the community aspect of it is definitely my favorite thing. And besides my ultimate favorite thing and seeing people unlock their potential and their results and break through barriers and their fears of the water and how long they can hold their breath or whatever that is.
Let's talk about your Free Your Mind handbook. You can find it on Amazon. Also, it says that there's another book coming, which I'm hoping is going to be your quote unquote journals that you say that you're writing. Let's talk about the Free Your Mind handbook, why it's good for people to use it, and then where they can find it.
Sweet. So Free Your Mind comes from the acronym that we use at Deep End Fitness and Underwater Torpedo League for training, for performance training, and to get someone to be able to navigate that survival situation that we were talking about, whether it's underwater or anything that's stressful like that. So the acronym is FREE, stands for focus, mental focus. So being able to close out all those mental tabs, just like a computer, so we could be singularly focused on one thing and making that thing something external. So you're focused out, you're not focused on yourself and the fact that you have water in your nose and your ear or whatever that is. You're focused, like laser focused on something external, which can be your hand right in front of you and you're just counting your fingers or whatever it is that's going to occupy your mind and occupy your focus. R is relaxation. So we say on-demand relaxation, but essentially you're relaxed as possible. You're not doing any extra energy or wasting any energy that you don't need to. And then you're basically putting yourself into low power mode and you're managing your energy expenditure. And then, so that's our E is economy of motion. So flow versus drag. So any extra movement or bad movement creates drag and it slows us down from our optimal performance. So this could even be like in your, you could use this a lot of areas of life. For example, we're talking about the pool. So the two biomechanics of swimming is increased propulsion and reduced friction. So every time we're trying to get more flow and reduce drag and find ways that we can be more efficient moving through the water. But in your life, that translates too. So there's a lot of these principles from free that started to translate into life. And so over time, it kind of, it grew more and more as we were doing so many trainings, training thousands of individuals, a lot of athletes, a lot of professional athletes, UFC fighters, NFL guys, Olympians. And so there's starting to give us a lot of feedback over the years that, hey, this free acronym, so economy of motion and then efficient breathing. We do a lot of upper regulation and then down regulation and different breathing techniques to navigate the situations and being underwater and breath holding and all of that. And so we get a lot of feedback that this is really life-changing tools that we're getting at the pool that are translating into other areas of our life. We're working better with our coaches. We got better relationships. Things are working. And so I started to work with some UFC fighters as a mindset coach and go into their fight camps using the free principles. And we would set goals and then work on through the free principles to improve whatever it is that they were working on and achieve their goals and win the fights. That was a lot of learning and had a lot of success working with those fighters. And then over time worked with other athletes, started working with executives in 2019 in a coaching role and doing some like beta tests with some of the executives that I knew out here in San Diego at Sony North America and some other places. Really had positive feedback from the programming of this. So one of the girls that's had trained with us in Orange County when my partner Don Tran and I went to New York City to do a demo for Deep End Fitness, this girl Bethany Marshall came out to the demo, and afterwards she said, "Hey, that manual that you guys are building, if you wanted to get it published, let me know and we can do that." And so she was working for Morgan James Publishing at the time. So she took the manual that we had built and turned it into a guidebook and published it like within a few, like probably towards the end of 2020, I believe is when we published it. So that was our first experience publishing anything and doing that. But from that project, Bethany and I stayed in contact. And a year and a half ago, she started interviewing me for a second book. That's basically the working title is Obstacle Equals Opportunity. It's all about working through the most challenging situations in your life and reframing them and using them to unlock as much results for yourself and other people. And using any of my like breakdowns or the lessons that I've learned in different ways as a case study to share with other people to help them with transition or dealing with trauma or dealing with any type of mental depression or those types of PTSD or, you know, PTS, whatever they're calling it. And so that book's almost completed at this point, like about to go into editing. So it's been a year and a half that she's been working on it with me and interviewing me and doing all that stuff. So that's been a really therapeutic process too, but a lot of crazy memories to go through in the last year and a half.
Yeah. And it doesn't help when assholes like me ask you to come on and tell your story. So you got to say them again. So man, you got a great story. Let's talk about where people can find you. Cause I want them to get more in depth with you. I want them to see everything that you're doing with the Torpedo League, with the handbooks, all that. So where can people find you?
The easiest thing to do is just go to Google and Google Prime Hall, my first and last name, and then all my stuff will come up. My Instagram is Primetime. My personal website is primehall.com, and that has all my like stuff that I'm working on and that. For for our volunteer nonprofit organization is called Operation Resilience. And we haven't talked about that, but operationresilience.org is the nonprofit foundation that we set up this year to work on suicide awareness and prevention and provide resources for individuals transitioning, not just from the military, but first responders and athletes and civilians as well. That is operationresilience.org. You could find it there. And we're looking for mentors and different individuals to get involved across the country, because there's networks of people that are looking for community all across the country in key cities, and people getting out and moving places that are looking to tap into communities. And really, it's just about connecting people and connecting resources, and also being a mentor at certain points, and being an ear for individuals that are going through a tough time that just need someone to talk to. So all of that work we do through Operation Resilience.
I think you would agree that someone that will just listen is probably one of the most helpful things to a lot of people. And people don't realize that, of just being a sounding board for them.
Yeah.
You have an amazing, amazing story. I'm so glad that you came on here, that we finally got everything out. We're going to add, because I looked through all your stuff today, we'll add that Operation Resilience onto the webpage, so they have that to click on there to be able to contact you through there. Everybody, you know where you can find Prime. Now let's talk about where you can find me. Of course, you can find me on Instagram at the DTD underscore podcast. You can find me on Facebook at the DTD podcast. And you can find me on YouTube, where all these conversations, they're in video form there. But your one-stop shop, dtdpodcast.net. Prime's going to have his own page there. He's going to have his own episode thing. It's going to have all of his links, all of his pictures, any way that you can get in contact with him or the organizations that he represents out there. Make sure you stop by there, because audio, video, everything is there. dtdpodcast.net. Now let's talk about people that help make this show possible. Our sponsors, you know them, Mac Belts and Police Coffee. Let's talk about Mac Belts first. Usually we talk about their leather belts, but let's talk about their synthetics. The Governor. It's laser cut from premium synthetic polymer with an impressive brake strength of 1,500 pounds. It's got handmade right here in the USA by SOF veterans. It's precision machine, Mac buckle, traditional style keeper, and locked with an anti-corrosive steel hardware. It's got a low profile and lightweight synthetic belt solution, and it's expertly designed to be unbreakable and all-weather capable. It's a perfect solution for your casual or dress wear, and ideal for utility or firearms carry. Everybody, we talk about it every week. My buddy Mac Alexander over there at Mac Belts, retired Navy SEAL. He's trying to make the toughest belts on earth and the best ones for you. Make sure you go check him out at MacBelts.com. Now let's talk about some coffee. PoliceCoffee.com. You know we talk about them every week. They're an officer-owned business, and they're dedicated to crafting the finest coffees and blends, and they're shipped as soon as they're made to provide you with the freshest coffee available. Their specialty coffees don't waste one drop when flavor's concerned, and their coffee, it's some of the best you'll find. The big thing about them is, we talk about it every week, 50% of their profits go towards helping officers who have family members of the police officers who fell in the line of duty. Let's talk about flavor. We've been talking about Texas all night, so let's talk about the pecan that they have. It's mild, it's sweet, it's a great, great blend. Pecan coffee, it's some of the best out there, and you can find it at policecoffee.com. It's rich, it's sweet, it's nutty, buttery, and it takes away from all the acidity, and you can find it at policecoffee.com. And when you put in DJK10, you get 10% off your order. Make sure you go check out our sponsors. They're who make all this possible. MacBelts.com and PoliceCoffee.com. That's going to be it for this week, guys. That's Prime. I'm DJ. Check us out on the next show. We'll see you then. We're out of here.